Governor Steve Bullock wants the Board of Pardons to recommend clemency for convicted murderer Barry Beach. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why a conservation group is suing to get a small population of grizzlies in northwest Montana listed as endangered. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with two experts on wildland firefighter safety. In an unusual step, Governor Steve Bullock has sent a two-page letter to the State Board of Pardons and Parole outlining why he thinks the board should recommend clemency for convicted murderer Barry Beach. The board is set to hear Beach's application for clemency April 29th. Beach has already served 30 years of a 100-year sentence for the 1979 murder of Poplar teen Kim Neese. He has long maintained his innocence and was granted a new trial by a district judge in 2011. He was released from prison for 18 months pending the trial, then returned to prison when the state Supreme Court overturned the district judge's ruling. In his letter to the Board of Pardons, Bullock cites the fact that Beach is not asking for exoneration, but a commutation of his sentence. Bullock also says Beach committed the crime as a juvenile, has served over 30 years for the crime, and would continue to be under state supervision if released. Bullock cannot commute Beach's sentence without the board's recommendation.
And in other news from around the state, the Alliance for the Wild Rockies is suing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for what the group believes is a failure to recover the grizzly bear population in the Cabinet Yak area of northwest Montana. The group says the Fish and Wildlife Service ruled in the early 30s that the Cabinet Yak grizzlies warranted being listed as endangered, and also that the population needed to increase to 100 bears to be considered recovered from that threat of extinction. Alliance Executive Director Michael Garrity says the current population is less than 50 bears.
We thought we waited long enough. It's been more than 20 years, and the bear numbers are declining at an increasing rate. So we don't think the grizzly bears in the Cabinet Yak have much more time.
Besides seeking to have the Cabinet Yak population listed as endangered, the lawsuit also wants the Fish and Wildlife Service to designate critical habitat for the bear.
Critical habitat means that the Fish and Wildlife Service is legally bound to recover the species instead of just trying to keep them from going extinct. And I think that's everybody's goal here, is to recover grizzly bears so they can eventually be delisted from the Endangered Species Act.
Garrity says the Alliance is not thrilled to be suing the Fish and Wildlife Service, but he says that if they don't act, the Cabinet Yak grizzlies are likely to go extinct. The Fish and Wildlife Service declined to comment until they have seen the lawsuit.
Montana's Attorney General intends to defend the state's limit on the punitive damages that can be awarded to an individual by a judge or jury. The Attorney General's office filed notice with the Montana Supreme Court yesterday that Tim Fox will intervene in a constitutional challenge of the $10 million punitive damage cap. District Judge Kurt Kruger of Butte previously ruled the cap is not a large enough deterrent for a big company. The ruling came in a case in which a jury awarded a $52 million judgment against Comerica, Inc. for reneging on a 2008 agreement with a Butte-based office supply company. The company, Masters Group International, is asking the Supreme Court to uphold Kruger's ruling that the state law setting the cap is unconstitutional.
Federal safety regulators are proposing $211,000 in fines for a Minnesota agriculture company that authorities say repeatedly failed to make sure workers weren't exposed to grain dust hazards in Montana. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration cited CHS Incorporated for 19 violations today following inspections at grain handling facilities in Cutbank, Glendive, Denton, and Valier. Three were repeat violations, including failing to test the air quality in workspaces for potentially explosive grain dust, hazardous gases, or lack of oxygen. 14 were classified as serious, meaning there was a substantial probability of a worker death or injury. The company has the option to contest the fines. A CHS worker was killed in Kansas in 2010 when he fell into what regulators said was an inadequately protected grain bin.
Signs have appeared along a closed portion of the Bitterroot River that say, "Free the River." Officials closed the river this month to floaters between the Woodside and Tucker fishing access sites near a diversion dam. A 6-year-old girl drowned there last summer, and officials say there have been a couple of close calls there this month. Pat Saffel of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says the agency is looking for comments on what should be done about the dam. The River Valley Republic reports FWP is looking to do an assessment to see how safety can be improved. Saffel says the closure will probably remain in place until the river's high flows stabilize in July, when additional warning signs should be in place.
Ground will be broken in Missoula tomorrow for 8 new apartments to provide permanent housing for homeless individuals. The $1 million cost of the Western Montana Mental Health Center project is being funded by the city's Home Investment Partnerships Program and a Community Development Block Grant. Center Development Director Patty Kent says the availability of affordable housing continues to be a big problem in Missoula.
But when it comes to persons who are disabled either by a mental illness, a physical illness, or simply homeless, where are they going to live? I mean, the average one-bedroom home in this town is $600 or $700 a month, one-bedroom apartment. So the result is homelessness.
Kent says the new apartments will provide housing for people with mental illness or HIV/AIDS.
The goal is to try to find those homeless persons with zero income who may be eligible for Medicaid and Social Security disability. Because then not only could we provide housing, we could provide some basic level of income and medical and mental health care for someone so they have a resource that they are eligible for that they just haven't been able to stabilize long enough to receive. It's a 1 to 2 year process. Even if you're deemed eligible today, it takes the federal government a year or two to decide that, yes, you are indeed eligible.
The new apartments are part of Missoula's 10-year plan to end homelessness. The housing project is named after John Ernest Lynn, the former deputy director of the Mental Health Center, who died last November.
He is just absolutely a dear man who committed his entire career to serving the mentally ill. He loved our clients and the staff who served them, and he actually started the Riverhouse program, which was a day program for persons with mental illness, many, many years ago on Front Street. And so having these apartments right across the street from Riverhouse, it just seemed like the right thing to do to have John there in his neighborhood with those that he loved and served.
The public is invited to join Mayor John Ingen for the groundbreaking tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock at 1347 Dakota Street in Missoula. Kent says, though, they hope to have the new apartments ready for occupancy by Christmas.
Montana's top wildlife official is scaling back expectations for a statewide bison conservation plan following backlash from ranchers opposed to restoring the animals to parts of their historical habitat. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Director Jeff Hagener told the Associated Press today that a pilot project to restore a small herd of 50 to 100 bison is a potential first step. That compares with an earlier proposal that would have established a new herd of roughly 1,000 bison as a way to help preserve the animal's genetics. Hagener says he hopes to compile a range of new alternatives before the legislature meets in January. Timing on a final decision is uncertain. State officials last week canceled a bison meeting in Lewistown after ranchers pledged to protest the event.
Health officials say 7 cases of whooping cough have been confirmed in and around Helena. Karen Wandell of the Lewis and Clark City County Health Department tells the Independent Record that 2 or 3 more cases would have to be reported to consider it an outbreak. Wandell says the cases began appearing this month and have affected children from preschool to high school ages. 4 of the 7 cases have been reported at Capitol High School. Whooping cough, or pertussis, is a contagious respiratory disease that can cause severe coughing. The illness can be potentially deadly to infants or small children who are too young to be vaccinated. Wandell advises parents to have their preteen children vaccinated and adults to make sure that they have had pertussis booster shots.
Montana State University's planning board is recommending a new $50 million engineering school be built where a parking lot, tennis courts, and a lawn now stand. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports the board voted yesterday for the site on Grant Street in Bozeman. The recommendation now goes to MSU President Waded Cruzado. Facilities Planning Director says other site options were either too small, too far from other engineering classrooms, or would cause delays in construction. The new College of Engineering building is being constructed with a $50 million donation from a graduate. The building is to be about 125,000 square feet. The board's vote was unanimous, though committee member Jim Thole says he is concerned about losing the only paid parking lot on campus.
3 new hotels are slated to open in Bozeman over the next 18 months. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports a 102-room, $22 million boutique hotel is being built on top of the historic National Guard Armory. The project, called the ETHA, will be run by Latour Hotels and Restaurants and is expected to open in the fall of 2015. Farther west on Mendenhall Street, a 104-room hotel called the Element Bozeman is being built by Homebase Montana. It will be operated by Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide, and it is scheduled to open in May 2015. The 38-room Lark Hotel is scheduled to open downtown in December after being rebuilt at the site of the former Imperial Inn.
The Missoula Technology and Development Center started as a support facility for Forest Service fire management in the 1940s when a small group began developing techniques to parachute men and cargo. Its role was expanded in the 1960s when a memorandum of understanding was reached between MTDC and the University of Montana. The MOU turns 50 this year and is being celebrated this week in Missoula. In tonight's feature interview, Edward O'Brien speaks with two men about the significance of MTDC and the impact of its relationship with UM. Dr. Brian Sharkey is Professor Emeritus at the University of Montana, where he served as Director of the Human Performance Laboratory. Sharkey has extensive experience in wildland firefighter safety and health research. Dr. Joe Dimitrovich is a Forest Service physiologist currently stationed at MTDC.
What we do is we look at the health and safety of wildland firefighters. So we look at nutritional standards, fitness requirements, smoke exposure, heat stress, all things that involve a wildland firefighter. We look at the health and safety aspects of those and how that can be improved.
Dr. Sharkey, what's the origin of this line?
I came to the university in 64, and our equipment consisted of a treadmill and a few pieces of equipment that would allow us to analyze respiratory gases. And that was about it. And over the years, with some help from the Forest Service, we were able to improve the laboratory. And then in the mid-90s, we started to make a lot more progress. We got more people on the staff and so forth. And now, at the university, I suspect we have at least three exercise physiology people and some other related areas. So the equipment in the lab at the university, labs, I should say, are much more impressive than they were when I arrived in 1964.
Dr. Dimitrovich, what sort of on-the-ground impacts that people can really understand and grasp onto has MTDC been responsible for when it comes to firefighting?
The cooperation between the university and MTDC, we've looked at nutritional standards. And about 4 years ago, after working with the University of Montana and MTDC on analyzing a firefighter's diet, how much energy they're expending, what they're eating, we've made some significant changes to the national lunch contract, which takes it more from a typical sack lunch to more of what a tactical athlete would eat is small amounts of carbohydrate throughout the work shift. And so that's an on-the-ground direct effect that the University of Montana and MTDC have had on firefighters probably in the last 5 years that's been most significant.
Yeah, explain more about these small bits of food. What difference does that make as opposed to a bologna sandwich and an apple?
We all love our bologna sandwiches and apples and out on the fire line. However, this constant feeding kind of just keeps the pump always full of fuel instead of putting in a large amount and then just kind of letting it trickle down. This kind of just keeps priming the pump every hour and a half to 2 hours to keep you at your optimal performance. Our studies have shown increases in cognitive function, increases in work output, increases in immune function, and also better blood glucose levels. With maintaining blood glucose, we see that wildland firefighters have better cognitive function, better productivity, better immune function, and just kind of overall feel better throughout the day. When it all comes down to it, what you put in your body and how you put in your body is probably one of the most important things we can do for our firefighters out there.
Is the work out there limited to nutrition?
There's also other developments. Back in the 80s or 90s, they worked on what's called the Combi tool, looking at tool design and how the human body can be affected by that. And by having different tool designs ergonomically, we can actually decrease the amount of energy used per swing of the tool. And this would help a firefighter over time reduce fatigue.
Hmm. Are there other organization centers like this in the world, or is this a unique place?
Well, the Army has a laboratory back east. In fact, it's right at the start of the Boston Marathon, Natick, Mass., that they do this sort of thing in terms of nutrition and fitness, and I'm not sure about the tools, but they do a lot of this. The difference there, a lot of those fellows are old colleagues of mine. They used to be jealous of the fact that when the university and the Forest Service combined on a project, the outcomes could be put into place rather quickly. Whereas with the military, they have these different branches, and they're like stovepipes, and one side doesn't communicate with the other. And so they may find out something that's very useful, but if the other side doesn't take it on and put it into practice, it doesn't get employed right away.
You said some of these ideas can be put into place rather quickly. Rather quickly meaning typically what?
Well, Joe was mentioning the shift food concept, you know, feeding throughout the day instead of just at the lunchtime. Mm. I think that was put into practice on an experimental basis almost immediately, as soon as we saw the value of it from some small studies. And then it is in a position to be adopted nationally for firefighting contracts everywhere, I guess.
We're here to discuss the 50th anniversary of the Wildland Firefighter Health and Safety Memorandum of Understanding between MTDC and the University of Montana. What is that history? What is it, and how did this come together?
Well, back in 62, the chair of our department, Walter Schwank, and another faculty member, Charlie Hertler, met with the person who head the Missoula Technology and Development Center, Herb Harris, and they talked about this idea of having some cooperative research. We had a faculty member, an exercise physiologist at the time by the name of Wayne Sinning, and I think, as best I can tell, he wrote the original draft for this, and then it, of course, had to be edited and so forth by both sides. But it was incorporated back in those days, and I think our department chair mentioned it to Mike Mansfield, and Mike talked on the Senate floor about this, what he called a unique project that combined these two groups to do work that was not only good for the university, but good for the Forest Service and good for the citizens. I like to comment that this is a very cost-effective program. We don't have big grants that go to one place and then they finish something and then it goes to somewhere else. We have this continuity, and we have people that are well-trained in working in the field. Before we can send a researcher out into the field, they have to be go through significant training, so they're not going to get in the way of things when it gets serious.
Was the University of Montana the research-focused institute it is today?
I remember when I got a research grant back there in the late 60s, they weren't that common. You know, it was just really starting to ramp up in terms of the granting process and how outside money could help the university not only do research, but also in terms of instruction for graduate students. And so it was all a very evolutionary process. And to have this agreement written up in 62 and 63, it's rather amazing. Not only that, it's rather surprising that it's still in effect. When I was working with the Forest Service near the end, they were concerned as to how to continue this process. You know, what can we do to make sure this goes on? They decided that they would hire somebody who already knew the business a little bit, having gone through our master's program here at the university. They had a process for people to apply for the job. They had to have finished their master's with the university and were willing to go on for their doctorate. That process is what led to Joe's being hired. He knows the faculty member. He knows what goes on in the—well, he knew these things before he was hired. You were a firefighter already, weren't you not?
Yeah.
So he was, an ideal candidate for the job.
Well, you're an inside and outside guy. You know what it's like on both sides of this, don't you?
Being a firefighter, I've seen the direct effect of the work they've done here out in the field. And you could say a couple of times it saved my bacon.
How so?
A couple of times we were out on some fires and fire behavior picked up. And some of the recommendations MTDC had given out for hydration, nutrition, led me to be at an optimal performance state to be able to react to the situation and get out safely.
I think you've already addressed this, Dr. Sharkey, but do you think this is more a historical relic than anything else, or one that will survive 2-3 decades into the future?
Well, I would like to think that it'll go another 50 years. That's all up to Joe.
No pressure, Joe.
to make sure. But I think a lot of it depends on having faculty at the university who are interested. And we have some faculty at the university who have a considerable interest. Charlie Palmer, Dr. Palmer, is an ex-smoke jumper. So he brings some interest and experience to the job when he looks at things in his area. And I think having that kind of people on the faculty is a smart move on our part, that is at the university's part, in terms of relating well to the folks in the agencies. And, you know, with budget cutbacks and all that sort of thing, there will be times when there isn't much money to do the things they'd like to do. So that comes and goes. But I think wildfire is here to stay. So we anticipate this should continue a long time. And I think the quality of the work that's being done now just keeps getting better and better in terms of their ability to look at things that matter a great deal. And to be able to study them in the field is rather unique.
What's happening later this week, Dr. Dimitrovich?
So later this week on Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m., we're having a celebration here at the University of Montana, the Phyllis J. Washington School of Education third floor atrium. We're going to have a little gathering to talk about this MOU, and Brian's going to give a little talk on some of the history and the highlights of it, and just to kind of get together to acknowledge the relationship the Forest Service at Missoula Technology and Development Center and the University of Montana have had over the years. This MOU has probably led to, I'd say, over 80 students getting master's degrees under mm-hmm. this project in the Health and Human Performance Department. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be discussing and kind of showing off some of the work that they've done. Anybody's welcome to come on down and partake in the celebration.
We hope that some of our old colleagues from the Forest Service over the years will hear this and it'll bring them out. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Brian Sharkey and Dr. Joe Dimitrovich, thank you both so much for coming in and telling us about this really impressive work.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and a slight chance of snow with patchy fog and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, rain showers are likely with highs in the 50s. For central Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with scattered snow and lows 30 to 35 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with slight chance of snow and highs 55 to 60 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies and scattered snow in the evening with lows 25 to 35 degrees and wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with snow likely through the day and a chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs are in the 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
Asked to name one idea that would change the world, venture capitalist Tom Perkins responded that wealthy Americans who pay more taxes should get more votes. Pay $1 million in taxes, get 1 million votes. His audience laughed. But Tom Perkins, a very wealthy man, wasn't joking. The sad fact is that, in a certain respect, his wish has already come true. A recent study by Professors Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page has confirmed what many people have long felt, namely, that America is more of an oligarchy than a true democracy. They examine the relationship between U.S. government policy and the preferences of the wealthy elite on the one hand, and the preferences of average citizens and mass-based interest groups on the other hand. What they found was that, quote, when a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites and/or with organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of the strong status quo bias built into the U.S. political system, Even when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy change, they generally do not get it, end quote. In other words, the wealthy usually get what they want, regardless of what the rest of us want. Welcome to the American oligarchy, the rule by the few. No wonder many people don't vote. Responding to the study, Manhattan Institute's Scott Winship wasn't terribly alarmed. After all, he claims, the middle class and upper class agree three-quarters of the time. So the fact that the wealthiest citizens have more influence isn't that consequential. In fact, he claims, it's possible that wealthier and business classes are better informed than middle-class voters, or that wealthier citizens favor better policies. Let's consider that for a moment. Where the wealthy are more likely to disagree with the rest of us is regarding policies that impact their wealth. While the wealthy of both parties tend to agree on such matters, the Republican Party's policies have been shown to widen economic inequality to a greater degree. Consider, for example, Representative Paul Ryan's recent federal budget proposal, approved by a majority of House Republicans, including Montana's Steve Daines. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, nearly 70% of the non-defense budget cuts over the next 10 years, equivalent to $3.3 trillion, would come from programs that serve people of limited means. For the wealthy, the budget cuts the top tax rate from 35 to 25% and eliminates taxes on income, such as on interest, dividends, capital gains, and estates. These and other measures benefiting the wealthy would cost us $5 trillion in revenue that could more than maintain the social safety net that the budget cuts. The upshot is that political inequality worsens economic inequality. A study commissioned by the New York Times just concluded that the American middle class is no longer the most affluent in the world. America's poor are now worse off than Europe's, but America's wealthy are outpacing most of the rich elsewhere. The top 10% wealthiest Americans took home over half of the income in 2012, the highest level in recorded history. There is, arguably, no more fundamental problem facing American society than our shift toward oligarchy. What's good for the wealthy is not always what's good for the rest of us. So what can we do? First, protect the vote. Efforts are underway across the country to throw up roadblocks to voter registration where no evidence of fraud exists. Such obstacles usually most disadvantage the poor. Second, vote. Look for candidates who promote fairness over privilege. Be wary of claims of fiscal responsibility that actually pad the pockets of the 1%. Look for a greater diversity of economic backgrounds among our representatives. The median net worth of members of the U.S. House and Senate is now over $1 million. Support bold measures that get money out of politics and promote equality and equal representation. Finally, stand up for equality whenever you can. Contact your representatives and express moral outrage. This isn't about class war or envy. It's about being shut out of a government that was founded to be a representative democracy, whose legislators, according to James Madison, were to exercise wise judgment on behalf of the good of the whole country. It's about the morally obscene results of policies that favor the rich while enhancing the suffering of the poor. In light of the Gillens and Page study, resignation and cynicism come easily. Hope, however, lies in the fact that sometimes the majority prevails, but only if we elect those who weight our interests equally. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.